Now we explore the scientific discipline that looks at death and dying from many perspectives. That is thanatology. And one entree into this conversation is the recent Asian elephant news. Yes, they were spotted on YouTube responding to deaths of their herd members. And this has helped researchers expand the field of comparative thanatology, how different animals react to death. Join in on the study of grief and death and loss, 800-642-1234. Janet McCord is director of the Thanatology Program at Edgewood College in Madison, which starts in the fall. She has been a thanatologist and suicidologist for nearly 30 years, former president of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, and serves on the board today. Janet, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm just really honored to be here.
Well, we always hear that everyone has their own way of grieving, their own path of mourning a loved one who has died. What new discoveries are thanatologists trying to uncover in the academic study, in the discipline of death?
Well, lots and lots of research is underway by multiple scientists, social scientists for the most part. I think probably the most important research happening right now is on the notion of complicated grief or complex bereavement disorder or any one of a number of other titles for that. But, you know, research continues in all areas of thanatology, including this notion of comparative thanatology that, is being done by primatologists and anthropologists, archaeologists, and other kinds of biological science.
I would imagine, the way animals approach grief and death could inform our understanding of how we respond to end of life. Are there connections there?
I'm not sure that there are. I haven't done a deep dive into that research. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's always been a tendency, especially in the 19th and 20th century, to anthropomorphize how animals respond to loss. They certainly seem to do that, and that's particularly true of elephants and some of the primates. So, and we don't really understand why. Even those scientists will tell you that they don't really understand why animals engage in behaviors recognizing a dead fellow member of their group. But they seem to. But we just don't know why. Is it grief? Maybe. It might well be. So
to be determined. Lots more to learn there.
Right.
I want to connect the word thanatology, and it, derived from the Greek word thanatos, meaning death. And your field, I understand, it really started taking off after World War II and people struggling with the enormous death toll. Can you explain the significance of its origins in light of massive losses of people?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. It's post-World War II discipline. It's a discipline that is multidisciplinary and transdisciplinary. There are no PhD programs in thanatology. And for now, I think that's probably a good thing. Most of us come from a variety of disciplines, including the social sciences like psychology and sociology and so forth. But what was happening in those years after World War II were two things. One, there was a lot of death, but there's been a lot of death in other wars. Mm-hmm. I think there was probably more death during World War I, and certainly the Civil War had an enormous toll. Slavery, the slave trade, had an enormous toll in terms of death. But what happened then also at the same time was that death was becoming increasingly medicalized. Many people didn't die at home anymore. Hmm. They weren't necessarily cared for by their families. Children did not learn about dying and death in their homes. Families were not living collectively as much in those years. And scholars started to notice, here we were putting people in nursing homes, in veteran facilities, VA hospitals, and so on, and people were dying at the hospital. I I grew up, I was born in 1954, so I'll just, I'm 68. And I don't remember anyone in my family dying at home. They went to the hospital for one disorder or another, and they died there. I wasn't with them, our family wasn't with them. So that makes things a little bit more difficult to deal
I
with that.
wonder, I wonder if it's, and I'm, this might not be the right word, but it's sanitized death in some
It
respects, or put it at arm's length, not immediate in the other room.
Right. No, that's absolutely the case. Sanitized is a good word for it. it is. It's medicalized. It has become a medical event. The way I look at it, and what guides my curriculum and the guides the way that I teach, is that dying and death and grief are primarily human experiences. They're human experiences that have medical aspects to them sometimes. But even if you think about people that are on hospice or have a life-limiting or terminal illness, how often are they seeing their medical caregivers? Maybe 15 minutes a month. So what are they doing the rest of the time? And this is a question that was asked by Alan Kelleher and others who developed this whole notion of compassionate communities and compassionate cities. And Kelleher would tell you, and I think he's an Australian who's done a lot of work in the UK, that dying and care for the dying and the grieving is everybody's business. And we need to prepare communities and help communities to support each other so that this dying business is not just about the medical caregivers.
And not in isolation.
Right.
I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk about the study of grief and death with Janet McCord, director of the Thanatology Program at Edgewood College in Madison, studying the impact, educating people on death, grief, bereavement. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Janet, why is your Thanatology program a Master of Science degree?
As opposed to what?
Well, it's a master's level. And so I would imagine there are undergraduate's degrees that would lead into it, that would feed into it. I just thought that was interesting that it is a master's level degree.
Well, I'll tell you that the first courses that were ever offered at universities back in the early 60s or the late 1950s were done in bachelor programs. And there aren't that many of them, though, even today, which is also very interesting to me. When I was teaching at another institution and I had undergraduate courses, those would fill up pretty quickly. But it's a master's degree because of the way that I started teaching death and dying in the first place at the university level. What I noticed is that hospices are required by Medicare to offer families 13 months of grief support after the death of a patient that's been enrolled in hospice. But Medicare doesn't tell hospices who to hire or how this needs to be done or what it needs to look like. And hospices don't get any extra money. This is all bundled in the daily rate that Medicare pays hospices for care. Many hospices, maybe even most of them, want a master's prepared person, but they don't want a licensed clinician. What they tend to hire or look for are social workers, not licensed clinical social workers, but social workers or chaplains to do this work. But social work programs and programs that prepare people to be chaplains don't provide a lot of education in death and dying or grief or loss. They just don't get that. They don't get that education in those programs. These are programs that are typically packed. Counseling programs is another example of curricula that are just packed with what is on the exam to get a license. And that doesn't leave any room for this death and dying and grief and loss. So I developed a curriculum originally to prepare people to do this work for hospices and hospitals and other organizations that offer grief support. What it turned out to be is something much bigger than that. And I was seeing people coming that were already licensed clinicians that wanted to shift their clinical practice to include grief and loss and realize they didn't know anything about it. Clergy persons who wanted to see bereavement ministries evolve in their parishes. Chaplains, educators at all levels, K-12 and even university chaplains. I had doctors and nurses. And here's another segment of the population who don't get much education, if any, on death and dying and grief and loss. They know the medical elements of dying, but they won't necessarily get education in the notions of mortality and recognizing our own mortality and grappling with that and reflecting on that. Child life professionals, funeral directors. So it became much broader than just hospices and helping people get those jobs to provide the grief support. And many of the graduates, the students that I worked with got those jobs, and they got those jobs because they had this education.
Janet McCord, who heads up the new thanatology program, it's a Master of Science program at Edgewood College as we explore the field of thanatology. Join in on the scientific study of grief, of death, bereavement, suicide, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute for more conversation with Janet McCord here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the scientific discipline and the holistic study of death called thanatology here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A thanatologist provides the services and resources around the subject of death and dying, and Edgewood College is preparing to launch a master's program. I was scrolling through job titles on Indeed and LinkedIn, and these skills, they translate into being a grief specialist or a hospice bereavement coordinator, as we talked about, perhaps an organ donor family services specialist. Join in on Death Science, the Meaning and Behaviors of Bereavement and Grief, 800-642-1234. Thanatologist and Program Director Janet McCord with us for the hour. Let's take a call now. Chris is joining us from Eau Claire. Chris, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say that thank you. I'm so interested in this. I'm a hospice nurse, and I have been for 30 years. And my background was just on my own, taking things. Back then, it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, learning as much as I could on my own about death and dying. And I've been listening to your program, and I totally agree with your guest in that I feel sometimes that I'm also not only helping the family, but the healthcare professional, whether it be the doctor or the priest or pastor that comes in, and I can see that they're very uncomfortable with what's going on. And so then you're helping them to help others. And I just can't say enough. I think this is something that should be actually not, well, I'm thankful for the master's program, but like even, I don't know, I just feel like it should maybe be 101 in school. And I totally agree, too, with your guest, as well as that it's not talked about. And we're still, even in this day and age and in America and in this culture, trying to make death and dying a comfortable subject. And so I just can't say enough. This is a wonderful program. Thank you.
Chris, thank you for bringing all those things up. Janet, what is coming up for you as you hear what Chris has to say?
Oh, Chris, thank you so much for your service as a hospice nurse. And you hit the nail right on the head that people are so uncomfortable with these situations where someone is actively dying. It's not easy. And as you know, Chris, every death is different. Every family is different. And there is, and all of those that are in that whole constellation of care are impacted by the dying process. So thank you again. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree that this needs to be a broader conversation in order to help families to have those conversations. My mother died in 2006. My brother found out on his way to the hospital that he was her power of attorney for healthcare. Mm. And he'd never had the conversation with her, because she just, well, you know, I put it in writing, except it was one of those forms that they had back in the 2000s and the late 90s about, you know, these are my wishes, but he still was not clear about it. So that's kind of what's coming up for me. You know, we need more education.
There is the fear of death, the fear of the end. You just mentioned the act of dying. How much emphasis do you place on, like, death anxiety reduction as part of a goal for efforts in death education, or maybe not at all?
Death anxiety is a real thing. What research tells us is that people aren't afraid of dying. They're afraid of being humiliated at the end of life. They're afraid of having to have their child take care of their bodily functions. They don't want to be a burden on others. And these are the drivers for medical aid in dying, as far as I can tell from the research that I've read. There is a wonderful researcher and palliative psychiatrist in Canada. His name is Harvey Max Chochenov. And I went up to Winnipeg and did his 2.5-day training on dignity therapy. And dignity therapy is an end-of-life intervention. It's actually being used in the San Diego area with early onset Alzheimer's. And what it is it's a one-hour interview where you ask the patient things like, what was the most important experience that you had in your life? What are you most proud of that you did? What wisdom do you want to pass on to your grandchildren? These are the kinds of questions, and elicit a conversation that lasts about an hour, is transcribed, read back to the patient, checked out for accuracy, asking the patient if they want to add anything to that story. Then it's put together, bound, and given to them. And they get to do with it what they want. But this is a legacy document. There are a number of different ways to develop a legacy document. I think it's the National Funeral Foundation, the National Funeral Directors Association Foundation, that have developed a set of cards. Like, it looks like a little deck of cards. And each of these cards have questions on them. And the idea here is to bring families together around the dining table, maybe at Thanksgiving or some other event, with multiple generations, and pass these cards out and encourage them to talk about their life, talk about how they think about death, talk about what it is that they want or don't want in their care. So talking about it helps. Getting educated about it helps.
Let's bring on Tyler in Baraboo. Tyler, you're on with thanatologist Janet McCord.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, no, this is my first time ever calling into you guys. I'm an avid listener. This topic is very interesting to me, and I had to call in. I think there's a very large disconnect. I have been a cop for 5 years, and I've met with families and in horrific situations, and where they have lost loved ones either by accident or by illness or age and whatever it may be. And I do strongly feel like there is a disconnect in between that, and that process is affected, the grieving process.
Tyler, what do you say, or can you share that type of experience with us?
Yeah, sure. You know, I guess I would say that, you know, it's one of two ways commonly where families are, you know, typically people don't die in homes and they get placed into nursing homes. And then throughout that process, I feel like there's a very large disconnect. It's kind of streamlined, honestly, where the family doesn't have a whole lot of involvement and everything is taken care of. And then you're kind of left with that immediate shock and burden of losing the loved one. And then when I've talked to people and informed them of their lost ones in a tragic, unplanned accident, and still like almost the exact same level of shock. But, you know, when I've talked to people, I've always found it best to be extremely direct. And, you know, when you have multiple when you've done a lot of them, you know, like you can walk someone through the steps and that seems to help. But there's definitely a disconnect.
Let's pause there, Tyler, get an answer on the other side of this news update. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the field of thanatology, death, dying, and bereavement here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When tragedy strikes, like school shootings, it comes as a shocking loss. Join in on thanatology, on collective grief, complicated grief. Your insights and experiences welcome. 800-642-1234. Janet McCord is director of the thanatology program at Edgewood College with us for the hour. Janet, Tyler and Baraboo brought up when they have to tell a family that their loved one has died. And Tyler said, be direct. And that, I know, is something you want to bring up as well when talking about death, because people often say, or they passed away, or they're no longer with us. What about that terminology?
Oh, let me just address Tyler first, if that's okay.
Sure.
Tyler, thank you so much for your service. And I think you're absolutely right that when you inform families about someone's death, you have to use the D word, and to be direct and to be simple. We know that children need to be told the truth, that they don't need to be protected, but they need to be told in ways that are direct, that are simple, that are responsive to their age group and their ability to understand. But yes, terminology is really important, and lots of people use euphemisms like passed away, went to a better place, living in heaven, you know, they've gone to heaven. And that can be particularly problematic for children because they wonder, can they go too? Or if they passed away, are they coming back? To use the D word is really important. Again, another example from my own life. My mother had had, go ahead.
Oh, I was just also going to bring up, what details should you share about death with a child? I would imagine it's very case specific, but what would you say there?
It is case specific. There are some experts that suggest that answer the questions that children have directly and honestly. A particularly difficult situation is when someone has died by suicide. Mm. And what do you tell the children? And I've known families who've said, you know, well, I'm not going to tell Johnny that his dad killed himself. And Johnny will learn it later. The problem with not revealing the truth or responding to Johnny's questions is that you can have a detrimental impact on your trust relationship with that child later on when they learn on social media or from their friends, because their friends probably were told by their parents that, yeah, Johnny's dad killed himself. So it's better to get ahead of that and talk to a child honestly and in a simple, straightforward way about what happened. You know, how the person died, not method so much, but most, okay? Accident, suicide, homicide, or sickness. You know, those are all the various modes of death that we have.
As we're talking about children, I just want to get your insights. What about open caskets and very young children? Should you take your child to the viewing, or at what age? How do you navigate that?
I don't have a problem with open caskets. I think they can be really important for families and friends to be able to see the deceased. If the deceased does not want an open casket, that should also be respected. I went to wakes with my parents from a very young age.
Me too.
And always was walked up to casket to view the remains of whoever was in it, because in those days, it was all open casket, or for the most part, it was open casket. So I don't have an issue with it, especially, but don't let the kid go up alone, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, go with them and answer questions and talk about how the person has been prepared for viewing. funeral directors are great heroes. Mm. They're great heroes because they will take a corpse and turn it back into a person. And that's a very important thing for families. I'm all for ritual. And of course, the pandemic has interrupted so many rituals mm. around because there just hasn't been an option for the past 2 to 3 years to bring people together closely. Now that's all lifting now, but you know, the whole notion of rituals is going to shift. It's shifted on the continent of Africa after Ebola or during Ebola outbreaks. When you have a West African tradition of embracing and washing and hugging the dead, if that person has died of Ebola, the officials can't allow families to do that because it's just so contagious. So what then you begin to see is funeral rituals and family rituals around what you do with your dead to shift.
That has implications as well. And it makes me wonder about the global community of thanatology and the contributions from other countries and traditions, you know, Asia, the Middle East, you mentioned Africa. You know, what is the international body of contributions in this research area as we look outside the U.S. to learn about death education and what we can take away from other cultures that are not our own?
There's a lot we can learn. I'm lucky to be a member of the International Work Group on Death, Dying, and Bereavement. We just had our 31st meeting in Norway a few weeks ago. And we're a group of people that come together about once every 18 months or so. And there are members from almost every continent, including the African continent. But it's challenging to bring people together when they have limited resources in order to travel and to be in another country for a week in order to talk about these things. But there's good research coming from around the world around death and dying and grief. There has been a lot of interest in South Korea because they've had some natural disasters that have resulted in mass deaths that they've had to deal with. There's some good research coming out of Singapore. One of my colleagues, Andy Ho, works with Harvey Chochenov and has worked with Harvey to take the dignity therapy approach, which in North America is applied to individuals. It's an individual intervention. But in the Chinese context, that doesn't make any sense because things are decided as families, as a family unit. So the family unit is much more obviously the unit of care. Mm. And so what Andy's research is doing is taking that and reapplying dignity therapy as a family intervention rather than an individual intervention.
Janet McCord with us, thanatologist, new director of the thanatology program at Edgewood College, previous president of the Association for Death Education and Counseling. And as we talk about grief and after someone dies, death education in America, 800-642-1234 to join in. Dick is here from Two Rivers. Dick, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, hi, Janet. Thanks for taking the phone call. I worked in physical therapy for 30 years. My question changed because you already answered it. And kind of near the end of my career, because of insurances and everything else, they would put hospice patients, which I don't have a problem working with. It has to do with the fact that they're not very rehabilitative and it should not be put in that position. Mm. So I'm not rehabilitating. I am making money for Medicare or the nursing home.
So Dick, I'm trying to understand what is the question or what are you trying to get at here?
Well, I want to ask Janet if if she's aware of what goes on in everyday life in the professional medical field.
Janet, what would you say there?
Dick, thanks for that question. It's a fascinating one. There seems to be a general culture around the medical profession that people are supposed to be healed, right? They're supposed to get better. They're not supposed to die. And often medical caregivers will see death as the enemy, rather than something that happens to us all. You're right. Hospice patients are not rehabilitatable. And, you know, you can't rehabilitate them in terms of their ability to move around. If physical therapy has a palliative goal, then that would be okay. I mean, there sometimes chemotherapy is used palliatively in the case of cancer, you know, the colon cancer, for example. If there's a very large tumor and the choice is apply chemotherapy to reduce the size of the tumor or allow that person to have a blockage, which is then an emergency situation, then go for the chemotherapy. But I don't understand, I don't know enough about physical therapy to understand why a hospice patient would be referred for hospice unless there is complete denial about what's going on with that person. So does that help, Dick?
No. No, thank you. No, it's very wise. Everything you said was very wise. I'm telling you, it has nothing to do, and I am more than loving and will hold a hospice patient up sitting by the side of their bed so they can maybe make a transfer to their wheelchair to the toilet. That's not the point. The point is it's all about insurance. It's all about the nursing home. You have different levels of medical care in a nursing home. They get better reimbursement. That's my point. It's like, God, man, you know.
Dick, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. And it sounds to, you know, Janet, going back to nursing homes and level of care, and as you said, the 13 months of grief support through hospice, it is all quite regimented. 13 months, you know, and not a day more. It seems very, very regimented.
Right. And you know, grief is the gift that keeps on giving. Okay. I avoid words like closure, which is one of the myths out there that there can be any closure. You know, when we grieve, it's forever. We're going to grieve the loss of someone that was close to us for the rest of our lives. And it's a matter of how do we learn to live with the fact that this person that we wanted to grow old with or, you know, or whatever is just not in our world anymore because that person has died. So that's what grief is about. The Acholi, which is a northern Ugandan ethnic group, they have a proverb: death is a scar that never heals. And I really like that proverb, because I think it's absolutely true. You know, I don't know much about insurance, and it doesn't surprise me what Dick had to say, but I find it that's really hard. But you know, it's not just medical caregivers that want to keep people alive forever. Families also, you know, it's something out in our culture right now in North America that somehow, you know, if we just give, you know, 89-year-old granddad some more care, then this time he'll come home from the hospital too.
Thanatologist Janet McCord stays with us on death, dying, and bereavement on the board of the Association for Death Education and Counseling, a group advancing diversity in death education, care of the dying, grief counseling, and research. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Janet McCord here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're discussing the field of thanatology, preparing to work in grief support within areas of healthcare, within areas of education, counseling, chaplain work. Thanatologist and suicidologist Janet McCord with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on another caller. Gary is with us from Ripon. Gary, hi.
Good morning. I think our farming out of the end of an individual life constitutes a denial of death. My mother died in her home in 2020, and I was living there with her when she died. She was not on hospice. And I got to tell you, everybody dies unexpectedly. Even though I knew she was deteriorating, and I would say to myself, well, you know, she's not going to live another 5 years. You just never know exactly when it's going to happen. And as far as grief goes, after a death like that, you can't short-circuit it. You know, a couple of months after it, I thought I was kind of past it or over it, but I wasn't. Maybe you never do get over it, but in my experience, it takes about a year, and maybe you're like 75% past it.
Mm. Gary, thank you so much and for bringing up those points. Janet?
Gary, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. And I think you're right. Everyone dies unexpectedly, even if we see it coming. And we know that it's coming. And there's never a good time for our mother to die. There is some research that suggests that 12 months is a pretty decent time frame for individuals and families to move through much of their grief. I think it's an arbitrary number of months because it's very different for various types of death. Grief is about attachment and the ways, and that's of course Bowlby's work and his attachment theory. And there are many variables that go into how we process a death, how we process our grief, and how we move through it. One is our attachment to the person who has died. Another is how the death occurred. Was it after a long illness? Was it suddenly? Was it violently that they were killed or killed themselves? Another factor is what kind of support systems does the person who's grieving the death of another person have? Just multiple variables that will have an impact on grief and loss.
You mentioned that the time, and what do you make of bereavement leave in our country? Most federal workers are allowed 2 weeks of paid leave following the death of a child. What is bereavement leave like in our country at this moment?
Bereavement leave, it's 2 weeks for the death of a child, seems very short. Hmm. And I don't understand how anyone would be able to go back to work full time 2 weeks after one's child has died. It's a short period of time. I think we do better with maternity leave, don't we?
Hmm.
Isn't it 3 months? So when babies are born, we give people time. When babies die or our children die, oh, 2 weeks should do it for you. That can be just too short. I don't know what they do in other countries, and mm-hmm. I don't know what all of the, you know, across HR, what people are allowed to do, but mm-hmm. hopefully they allow people to have the time they need to process what's happened and to begin to move to a place where they have the support structures that they need to begin to put their lives back together.
Mm. Gary, thank you for the call. Colleen now in Milwaukee. Colleen, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Colleen. We can hear you.
Hi, I am so excited to hear the show. I'm a nurse. I graduated in 87, and I was working at a hospital in Oregon, in Coos Bay, Oregon, and there was a man that was dying. He was in the end of the hall, the last room to the left, you know, and it was, you know, hardly anybody attended to it. And being a new nurse, I wasn't sure what to do. I just did what my heart told me to do. The woman, his wife, was sitting in the corner crying and just so sad. And, you know, she's trying to contain herself. And I walked in, and the last sense to go, from what I understand, is hearing. And he was not conscious.
Mm.
So I went up to him, and I felt like I was going against all that I had learned as a nurse. But I went up to him, and I just whispered to him, and his wife heard me. I said, "It's okay to die." I said, "It's okay to let go." You know, I said, "It's all right. You can let yourself go." And that night, it felt very strange to do it. That night after I had left, he died that night. And I got a note from his wife that just thanked me up and down for, she says, your spirituality as a nurse was just so touching. I just can't thank you enough for what you did.
Oh, Colleen, thank you for sharing that deeply personal story. Janet, we only have a few moments left.
Right. Colleen, thank you. That was a very compelling story. And it's people do, we think, hear at the very end and sometimes need permission. I'm not of the mind that no one should die alone. I think oncology nurses will tell you that sometimes a dying patient will wait until the family left to go get a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. And they take that moment to die because they don't want the other ones there. They don't want their family members with them. So how would you like to wrap this up, Kate?
Oh, we are out of time. It is fascinating. Janet, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Janet McCord directs the Thanatology Program at Edgewood College, a master's program launching in the fall. She is a thanatologist and suicidologist for nearly 30 years. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.